As the slide comes up, it's going to contain the title of today's message, The Enduring Truth, The History of the New Testament Church. This probably strikes a little fear in your heart as you wonder, how are we going to cover this in the next 12 hours? As we start to dig into this subject, it truly could be, it's more than a semester class. It's a two-semester class. I say this, and it's up on the screen to say that this is going to be the start of a series of sermons. And a series that I hope we will find very important, helpful, and informative. And what I hope it does is gives us some context into which the New Testament was written and into which the Gospels were written and the book of Acts and the events that are recorded, really the history of the New Testament church, is it all starts in Acts. And then the epistles or the letters of Paul and how Paul wrote to his congregations and what he wrote about and why he wrote these things specifically, and perhaps it will help it start to make a lot more sense. And then the general epistles, the James and the John and Peter, and of course Revelation as well. And hopefully they go from being black and white to three-dimensional, and we can start to visualize in a different way what's going on. Even the background for the title slide here shows a part of the Arch of Titus. And just if we were to, we could probably do a whole message just on that picture alone. That's the Arch of Titus. It was built in 81 AD, commemorating Titus's sack of Jerusalem. There had been a rebellion in Jerusalem for several years, and he was sent to suppress that rebellion, which he did, and they demolished the temple. And here you're seeing the Romans returning to Rome and marching in and carrying artifacts from the temple in Jerusalem. You see the menorah there, fairly famous, and the showbread, table of showbread, and some of the different symbols that they used for the sacrifices and that. So, again, here's a three-dimensional element that we can learn so much about, and that's that arch is now in Rome, and some of you have had opportunity to attend the feast in Italy, which is about an hour outside of Rome, and it's a real blessing to be able to go into Rome a time or two during the feast and to see these pieces of history come alive. And start to put, again, context to it and understand some of the words that were written in this time frame in a deeper and more meaningful way. So we hope that through this sermon series that these elements will become three-dimensional and they'll become alive in your mind. And, of course, we're going to understand their applicability today in a whole new context as well. Have you ever heard it said that every pastor or every speaker has three sermons, and that every sermon they give is really some variation of those three themes? You ever heard that? You might notice that there are speakers and they'll have their areas of interests and aptitudes, and we're blessed with almost 20 on the speakers list now. And all have their different history and backgrounds and interests and aptitudes and abilities to speak on different things. So we get a well-rounded diet here, and that's a pleasure. And of course, we have different authors of the Bible, the 66 books of the Bible, and the different authors there that also had their different strengths and interests. And so that it's been said that, you know, there are letters of hope, and there are letters of love. John wrote about love, and there are letters of James wrote about faith and of works, and so we see that in those articles. Well, as we get to know ourselves as speakers, I'd say that I have a couple of themes that interest me, and you'll probably recognize these as we label them. One theme is of truth, and the absolute truth, and how important it is to know and understand and recognize the difference between truth and that which is not true, and really love and value and appreciate that truth. That's something that is always in my mind, and I think comes out very often in different types of messages. And another is endurance. Endurance. And staying faithful to that truth all the way to the end. All the way to the end. And that's been a theme, I'd say, in my life. It's been important. My DNA seems to have some endurance gene in there. I was never fast enough to be a sprinter. I always wished I could have been, because in track and swimming, they had the easiest workouts. They were just short, fast and short. And I wasn't really fast enough to be the long-distance runner, but that mid-distance. So you had to run far and fast. It was horrible. But that's kind of what we're called to do in many ways, is we have to make progress with the time that we have, and we don't know exactly when that finish line will be, but we do know that we're to be preparing until our last breath, and that we must endure until that end. And so, studying the history, studying the truth, studying the context into which the New Testament was written, we see that these themes are so important, and thus the title, The Enduring Truth. We're going to talk about that more in a minute, but let's turn over to John 17. Again, part of the recurring theme. This is one that I don't think we can turn to too often. It's so critical. It's so important to really understand what's going on here in John and how it applies to us, because we're reading one of Christ's last recorded prayers. And he's saying in this prayer that he does not pray that you should take them out of the world. He's praying to God the Father. He says, I don't pray that you should take them. And he's talking about who? His disciples and you. And all of the disciples that would come along. Are we disciples of Christ? We are. Which is far more than students. And you recognize these conversations from previous messages, right? Students can learn from a teacher, but not even agree necessarily with every aspect of that teacher, what that teacher stands for. But they can still learn, because the teacher may have areas of expertise that they can learn from. So a student learns from a teacher. That's a very different relationship than a disciple and their rabbi or teacher, is it not? That's one of the things that we learn about from history. As we study history, we learn what that rabbi's role was. We learn that disciples were very different than students. They lived with, they walked with, they did everything with their teacher. They became their teacher, ultimately. They became like their rabbi. That's the relationship that they had, and we learn that by studying the context, and we start to apply that to our lives as well. And so here, Christ is praying for his disciples, which includes us as disciples of Christ, and he's saying, don't take them out of the world. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could just be completely separated? From time to time, we have that wonderful blessing, right? We can go to the Feast of Tabernacles, and we are out of the world. In fact, we have the weekly opportunity to pause the treadmill of life that we run on 6 days a week and step away from that and rest and come together, however we may come together, and share time together and turn our attention towards our teacher, our elder brother, our rabbi, and become more like him. Think about how we can become more like him. Think about what he taught us. Read what he taught us. And here these words are recorded. I don't pray that you take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. our adversary. We have an adversary. We'll talk about him as well. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. So we read about in the first message today, very appropriate, as he dug into the history and helped illuminate it and helped us to understand the application today. And he talked about citizenship, and we have a dual citizenship, we might say. We have the citizenship of this world where we're in on a daily basis, and then we're also citizens of another country, a heavenly country with all the elements that are part of that kingdom, the leadership and the laws and the people. Yet we're in this world, but not of it. That is the tagline for our young adults. In, not of the world. And Connor and Courtney had some very nice stickers made up to go on our water bottles or coffee cups. In, not of the world. And it shows a horizon of some mountains as we have the vision of the future. So here Christ is praying. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them, set them apart by your truth. Your word is truth. That's the source of absolute truth. That's what we come to study. That's what we want to learn more about, is the truth. And there is a source of absolute truth. And we believe that it's the Creator that inspired it. Here it's red letters, Christ's own words himself. And we can know what is true. We're set apart by that truth. And we must know that what we learn is true. And we must believe that it is true. We base our entire life around these beliefs. It changes everything for disciples, for those that decide to become disciples of Jesus Christ. It changes everything. It's the process we call what? Conversion. Conversion from what? From what our priorities and thoughts and life would have been like before, without an understanding of and access to what? The truth. We call it the truth. We come to a knowledge of what? The truth. And it changes everything for us. We learn, we teach, we believe, and we stand strong, and we endure to the end because of our understanding of the truth. Some of you may have heard this sermon. Some of you have heard different variations of it many times. Dr. Ward has what he calls the three C's. The three C's are conviction, commitment, and courage. These words are powerful words, and they speak to what we develop as we come to understand the truth and we dedicate ourselves to it. We commit ourselves to it. We're convicted of the truth, and we have the courage to base our life's decisions and our choices in the face of whatever adversity we may face, because we have the courage to do so as a result of our conviction and our commitment. No matter what, the truth will endure. It always has. From the time these words were written until now, we cannot draw a thread and a string through the true church. There are some dark ages in there. There are some times when the history is ambiguous, and we don't know exactly where that truth was, but we can be certain that there are always those who know, understand, and believe the truth. And the truth will never die. It has always remained and will continue to remain. The question that is asked of us and that we answer throughout our lifetime is whether we will remain, is whether we are convicted, whether we have the commitment, whether we have the courage during our time just the term or the thought of studying history may make some of you break out in a cold sweat. You may have PTSD from junior high, high school, and college classes where you were forced to memorize dates and ranges and people and try to get all these dates and people in order. And it may be like a puzzle gets dumped out on the table and you're supposed to know where all these pieces go, and every question on the test is like a piece of the puzzle and you're supposed to put it in the right order. That can be difficult and challenging. And unfortunately may create a distaste for history and the study of history that we will try to overcome. Because there is a reason to study history. And there is a benefit to it. And it can be an acquired taste as well. Our tastes do change over time. As we grow, as we mature, you may have never liked mustard, and then one day you taste it, somebody makes a sandwich for you, which it always tastes better when somebody else makes your sandwich, right? Except if it has mustard on it, and you think, what is this stuff? Well, who did this? Why is there mustard on my sandwich? But wait a minute, maybe I do like mustard. And you realize your tastes may have changed. Our tastes do change over time, and our appreciation and desire to study history may change over time as well. And especially if we can understand that there can be a good reason to study history, and hopefully that's what we're doing today. Hopefully what we're doing today is stimulating a little bit of interest in what is going to come. And setting, if for lack of a better term, it's building the foundation upon which we're going to build on. It's been said that history repeats itself. Have you heard that? And that those who don't study it are doomed to repeat it. Does anybody know who Samuel Clemens is? Samuel Clemens wrote under the pen name? Mark Twain. And he had a knack for these pithy comments that stuck with you. And he said, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And it, well played. Why does it do that? Why does it do that? Mark Twain also said, a favorite theory of mine is that no occurrence is sole and solitary, but is merely a repetition of a thing that has happened before, and perhaps often. Now, when did Mark Twain live? Yeah, well, in the 1900s, right? That's one thing we'll study. I'm glad you bring that up. In the 20th century, right, in the 1900s, what century are we in now? The 21st century. So when is the first century? What does the date of the first century start with? Zero. Yeah, it doesn't start with a one. That would be the second century, because then you're into the second century. Mark Twain was observing that history rhymes because people and their patterns of thought are the same throughout time. God is the same throughout time. The adversary, throughout the time the man has been created, has also remained the same. So we have the three main players in every story that are the same. The people and their thought process, Satan and his adversarial destructive methods, and we'll call it toolkit, perhaps. We can refer to that in different ways. And we have God, Father, and his Son, the one who became his Son. And so when we see all of those blended together, we see the same tools and the same process happening over and over. Who is the creator? God is the creator. God, the God family, Elohim. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and all things were created through the one that became Jesus Christ. But it was the God family that created this. Elohim created all that we see. They're the creators. Does Satan create? He destroys. His role is the adversary. He tears things down. He destroys. We see that over and over and over again. We see his playbook and how he destroys. He doesn't need to be real inventive in his methods, does he? Why? Because he gets a new generation to deal with all the time. who just keep coming. New generations keep coming. So he can keep doing the same thing that he's done over and over and over again. Slightly different ingredients. History doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it can rhyme. Let's turn to Hebrews 13:8. Again, as we set the stage here, we read the author of Hebrews informing us that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So he says in verse 8 of Hebrews 13, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. His thought processes, his alignment with the Father are the same. Verse 9 carries a warning. Do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines. So it's saying that know that Jesus Christ will not change. So when you hear new truths, when you hear something that doesn't align with the truth as you understand it, this is first of all stating an absolute fact that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Our understanding of what he said may change, but what he said does not change. And he doesn't say something different than what he said before. It's amazing that with all the authors of these 66 books of the Bible, they never contradict themselves when properly understood. We've talked about that in this congregation before. How many authors are there of the Bible? Does anybody remember?
One.
Yeah, one. So that one, God, inspired all the authors. And I forget at the moment, actually. It's 35 or 36, I think, authors of the Bible. Two numbers are popping into my head, 35 and 43. And I may have made them both up. I don't know. But I know there are 66 books and that God inspired all of them. Timothy, we read that in 1 Timothy. But do not be carried about by various and strange doctrines. That's one thing that we're going to study about in history, is that different teachers came along and taught different things that were contrary to the truth. A doctrine means teaching. So we have the teachings that we base on the truth become the doctrines of the church. And there are false doctrines, and that's the warning here. So we begin with the end in mind. We're beginning with the end in mind as we start this series. Our goal is to come to better understand the truth. As it says here, do not be carried about by various and strange doctrines. We read in Psalm 1, too, that Psalm 1, let's just turn to Psalm 1. Speaking of doctrines, it's doctrinal that Psalm 1 must be the first hymn, the basis for the first hymn in every hymnal of the true church. Is that true or false? It's kind of a joke. But blessed and happy is the man tends to be Psalm 1 of most hymnals in the modern era. And so here we're reading about the basis for the song that we sing, blessed and happy is the man. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the paths of sinners, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and he meditates on it day and night. And I'm skimming through here. It says, he will be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in season. Whatever he does will prosper. So you're envisioning now this tree that's planted by a river, and you can imagine the leaves that come forth in season, and it's a solid, well-fed, strong tree. And then there's this contrast to the ungodly. They are like the chaff which the wind drives away. The chaff, which is the worthless part of the wheat, as they thresh the wheat, the wind carries it away. They don't have that grounding. They don't have that mooring. They don't know the truth. And so the winds blow them around. And so that's why it's so important that we're anchored in the truth. And that verse 2 is telling us what that is, in the law of the Lord. So in this law, in this truth. And we're being cautioned not to be blown around by various and strange doctrines. So the end in mind here is to create immunities. We've just had an interesting year in 2020, so maybe this analogy helps us to understand it more deeper and better, that viruses come and blow through. They blow through from time to time. It has been said that we are in unprecedented times. It's been said that nothing like this has happened before, but that's not really true. Maybe it's true to an extent, and then it wasn't exactly like this, but here's how it rhymes. 1793, the government was shut down. Everyone had to go shelter in place at home because of a plague that blew through the eastern part of the United States. The actual government was shut down. Washington had to go home. Jefferson had to go home. They shut the whole government. It was in Philadelphia at the time. And 10% of the population of Philadelphia died as a result of the yellow fever. And it was horrible. And by the way, the political environment was such at the time that the Democrats and the Republicans were fighting so much, and they had both of their own versions of the press that were saying such destructive comments. There was no pretense of objectivity with the press at the time. They were basically propaganda tools of their political party to tear down the other side. And they thought at the time, Washington wrote that if something doesn't happen, this could erupt in a war, a civil war, in a government that was barely just founded. It was President Washington was in his second term, just into his second term at this point. And he was concerned about what would happen if this continued. And it was, in this case, that virus that blew through that caused everything to settle down a little bit, gave everybody, it was like ringing the bell and everybody went to their corners for a little bit. And we know that it continued. Does that rhyme a little bit? It's interesting. But what we want to do as these pandemics blow through, and even in our lifetime, we've had more than one. We've had SARS, we've had H1N1, we've had Ebola. So these things do come through, and they also come through spiritually as well. And they're not new tricks. They're not new novel viruses. They're the same ones that have been blowing through the churches for all of these years. And we're going to study them in the context of the New Testament. They come through, they infect people, and they create a spiritual mortality rate. And they do take people out. They do distract, and they do infect and affect people. And so what we're going to do by studying the truth is create immunities to that so that we recognize what is false. We very clearly recognize what's false, what is counterfeit. We know that Satan does that. Let's turn to 1 Peter 5:8. 1 Peter 5 says, encourages us. This is a letter from Peter to his congregation. His letter says, be serious. Be sober. Take this seriously. Pay close attention here. Be vigilant, as a watchman is vigilant, as someone on guard is vigilant. That would have been a term that would have been meaningful to the first century church. Be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. So it's saying be watchful and vigilant against the methods of our adversary, which are to blow winds of doctrine through the church, and they can capture our minds and our imagination and our thought processes and distract us from the truth and create problems. And this has been true. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. And we might just extend that a little bit, take a little license there and say, in all the world, through all times. Because this was written then and it's true now. It's just as applicable to us now, is it not? So, it's saying watch for Satan. Watch for the devil. And so, we get to know the truth. We get to know ourselves. Because it's important that we come to understand ourselves and our own patterns of behavior and our own weaknesses and the way that we're prone to fall. It's important that we get to know ourselves and we get to know Satan as well and how he tempts us and how he personally, carefully crafts a plan for us. We read about that in Job just recently, did we not? God says, have you considered my servant Job? Satan says, oh yeah, I know everything about Job. Not just Job, he knows everything about you too. That should be scary. That should be sobering. And Peter's saying, be sober. That should be sobering to think that God, or that Satan very specifically knows us. But we do also have an advantage in that we can know him, because his tactics are well recorded as well. We can know him. A proverb from Sun Tzu says, know yourself and know your enemy, and you need not fear the result of 100 battles. He says, if you only know yourself, you'll win half the time. If you only know your enemy, you may win half the time. If you know yourself and your enemy, you don't need to fear the result, because you recognize the patterns and you see what's happening, and you can better react. So Satan's plan is well known. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, the pride of life. Those are his temptations. 1 John 2:15 tells us that. And in John, he's writing to combat many of these teachings. And we'll look into that more. This is how Christ was tempted. We can read the temptation of Christ. Satan didn't tempt Christ by saying, lie about something or steal some bread. You're hungry. You haven't eaten for 40 days. Go steal some bread. He didn't do that. He appealed to the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, if you are the Son of God. So we learn about Satan's tactics, and we can see them. That temptation of Christ and his plan, or Satan's plan to destroy and to appeal to humans and get them to make the choice to sin, because Satan can't make you sin. Only you choose to sin. He just puts the choice in front of you and makes sure that that choice is ever present. And so we can recognize that. We read about the temptation of Christ, and we can see how it has applied to every Christian of every era, from creation until today, and it will until Satan's influence is permanently removed. From Genesis to Revelation, the adversary has been hard at work with the sons of men. We're introduced to him in Genesis 4, verse 5. And again, what tool did he use? As he put that fruit in front of humans, did he say, steal it? No, he just said, choose. You have to choose. But he implied that, let's just turn over there. Genesis 3, and he asks the question, he gets engaged here with the human, verse 1. The serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field, and he said, has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Well, I think this can be a warning symbol for us. When we even start to engage in thought processes that are going the wrong way, that's the time to stop, but she didn't. Maybe she didn't recognize the danger here, but she says, yeah, God said you should not eat of that, lest we will die. The serpent then shares with us some of his tools. He says, you shall not surely die, true or false. She didn't drop dead. Started a process of death. She does eventually die, and every human sense does die physically. Yet, it was also partially true. So we see that Satan blends truth and error, blends a lie with the truth. See that tactic. God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. So now he casts doubt on God's motives, that God has selfish motives. He doesn't want you to be like him. That this God, he creates division between God and humans, and we see that division does show up as they hide from God, who they used to walk with. God knows that you will become like him. And does sin separate us from God? Isaiah 59:2 says, our sins separate us from God. They build up a wall between us. And we see it right here. This playbook is all playing out. You will know good and evil. He also tempts with knowledge. You'll have knowledge, special knowledge, secret knowledge, something that's valuable. And we as humans, that's part of our patterns of thought and behavior. We do crave knowledge. And we can be on that treadmill of constantly acquiring knowledge, and Satan is throwing that out there, that this will give you that special knowledge. And so then she did what Satan could not make her do, but she chose to eat it, and then Adam did afterwards as well. So ever since that time, Satan has worked with humans to drive a wedge between them and God. And he knows that if he can get a little wedge in, he can start to exploit it and create more and more polarization and get the distance farther and farther and the wall in between higher and higher and thicker and thicker. And it becomes harder and harder to overcome it. That's the way he works with all of us. He tries. Another recurring ploy of the adversary is to present counterfeits. There's something that looks and feels similar, then it may be accepted. We've also seen that this has affected every group of people through time. The study of humans or man is called anthropology. We might have called it social studies in school. Anthropology, social studies, this study throughout time has shown that humans have a place for God in their hearts and their minds and their spirit. God put in us the spirit of man. And optimally, he combines the spirit of God with the spirit of man, and then we become what? Romans 8:14, children of God and joint heirs with Christ. That's optimal. If we don't have that, what happens? What do humans do? And especially under the influence of Satan, they make something up. They make something up, a proxy for that, something to help satisfy that curiosity. And that they, without anything else, without the truth, they look to what? The creator or the creation? The creation. And then they start to worship the creation. And we're physical. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, that's what we know. So you see that over and over again, you see this, some version of putting something in place of God, but not an ultimate creator. And so we start to understand that. Yet, Christ prayed that we would be set apart by the truth. And so as time goes on, teachers came of this truth. And we're reading about Paul in the epistles of Paul in the New Testament. And we need to understand something, that during the life and times of the New Testament church in the first century, they didn't have the New Testament. They only had the Old Testament, and they had their life experiences. And so they had their life experiences, and they had a generation that had studied under Christ himself, which the whole world acknowledges. There's too much history that proves this with absolute certainty, that Jesus Christ did exist. The argument might be, was he a great teacher? Was he the Son of God? Was he God in the flesh as he said he was? Or was he a great teacher, or a great philosopher, or a great rabbi? Very impactful. And so they can't refute that he existed. There's too many writings, biblical and otherwise, that confirm his existence. Yet, they'll try to argue of what his role was. So what we're seeing in the first century and what we're reading about is a group of men who had studied under him, or like in Paul's case, knew of him and was persecuting right away, 31 AD, those that were believing and following him. And now they're at the point where they're reaching the end of their lives, and they're starting to understand that Christ is not going to return to set up his kingdom in their lifetime. And they know that if they don't start to document what they read and what they heard and write these things down, then it could be lost, because this history wouldn't be preserved. So it was in 60 AD, 60 to 90 AD, that these books were written. In many cases, towards the end of their lives. So in 90 AD, now the church was 60 years old. Some interesting parallels, by the way, is that the church in Phoenix is 60 years old. And if we look at the church in modern history, there have been some great teachers, some that studied directly under them. They've passed away and have been gone for 30, 40, 45 years. Some of those that studied under them and knew what they taught are starting to pass away. We've had many patriarchs in this congregation that have passed away over the years. Some recently. And it's important for us to keep doing that as well. Because they were here, they occupied a place in time and in history, and they did their job and passed things on, and that's what we're doing now. And Titus, we just went through Titus, said the older men should be teaching the younger men. They should be sober. They should be good examples. They should be passing it on. The older women should be diligent in passing what they have learned on to the younger women. The younger women and younger men should be willing to learn from the older men and the older women. And then it should keep going to the youngsters, the children. And we've got a whole nother generation coming right now in the mother's room here. Babies that are yet unborn and just recently born, and they're coming along. And you guys, young men, are going to need to teach them because we'll be gone. It's your job. It'll be your job to staff the camps because our knees are gone, our shoulders are gone. We won't be able to be there anymore. The guys that were there when I was a camper are gone. And now we're that staff that puts things together. And it's your job next. And that's where we are in this history because the book of Acts isn't over. We have 1 Peter, 2 Peter. We have 1 John, 2 and 3 John. I think we also have the Acts. You've seen this slide recently. The story continues in Acts. It keeps going. But we're going to study the beginning, and we can think about how to apply it in our lives as we continue to move on. And it's up to us to do this. Timothy was encouraged. Let's turn over to 1 Timothy 4. 1 Timothy 4. And we'll finish with this, and then we'll pick it up from here. Now, the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, so this is connecting the dots from this New Testament time to now. We've all felt like we've lived in the latter times, and surely we do. But it says, in the latter times, some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and the doctrines of demons, false truths, teachings that come from who? The adversary. They're not true. And if they're lies, they're not true, they're lies. And if they're lies, they're of the father of lies, which is the devil. So he's saying here, these are doctrines of demons, teachings of demons. This correlates well with 1 Peter 5:8 that says, be sober, be vigilant. Pay attention to these things because it's true and it happens at all times. Speaking lies in hypocrisy and having their conscience seared with a hot iron. That can happen as we as humans are capable of rationalizing decisions and moving away from that truth and progressively farther and farther away. So Timothy's task is outlined in verse 6. It says, if you instruct the brethren in these things, if you instruct them in the truths, you will be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished in the words of faith and of the good doctrine which you have carefully followed. So he's saying, Paul is saying to Timothy, a young pastor or a new pastor, say these things, preach these things, teach these things, and be a good minister. That's how you do your job well, is to do these things. Reject that which is false, old wives' fables, and exercise yourself towards godliness. Verse 11, these things command and do and teach. And we'll flip over to the very end of 1 Timothy. In verse 6, chapter 6 and verse 20, it says, O Timothy, this is his conclusion. This is the summary. And this is what we're going to attempt to do in the next series of sermons as we go through the history of the New Testament church. As we go through some of those winds that have blown through, that have been, now we have terms for these. Gnosticism, for example. Gnosticism is the root of the word Gnosticism is gnosis, which is knowledge. So the special knowledge that has blown through from time to time. We're going to study it. We're going to see what it was then and how it affects us now. This is what Timothy is told. O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust. Avoid the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. Avoid false knowledge, false truths. By professing it, some have strayed concerning the faith. Grace be with you. Amen.